if you want to go back with your friends.
I think I'll go back, she said. I have lecture notes to go over and a project to work on, and I'll go over and clean Angela's flat and feed Doorknob. She left it a mess. I might stay there until she gets back.
Good idea, Sebastian said.
I have a stupid question, Stevie said. I wanted to get something for my dad. He loves whiskey, and I can buy it here legally. This immediately caught the attention of all her friends, who knew that there was basically no way in hell Stevie was bringing her parents home a bottle of whiskey. A magnet, maybe. And this is weird, but in the statements I was reading about this amazing bottle of whiskey, you drank something, you know, and I know you know whiskey.
Oh, that whiskey,
Sebastian said, nodding.
I don't think you're going to find that one at duty-free, and if you did, you wouldn't buy it.
Why?
Because it cost £10,000,
Sebastian said, slicing himself a large chunk of sausage.
In the 90s, it would probably be about £40,000 today.
You drank a £10,000 bottle of whiskey? Stevie said.
Oh, yes. Every drop. You were obsessed about that whiskey, Peter said. I wasn't obsessed with it. My father was. He sought rare bottles, and that one was the rarest of the lot. He seemed to value that bottle of whiskey more than me. I was determined that we should drink it as a symbolic gesture.
Except you almost knocked the house over getting it out of the cabinet, Yash said.
I remember approaching the cabinet elegantly. You crawled, Theo said.
With a candle in your hand, Yash added, which I took. Then you banged and scratched that cabinet door until Peter got on his hands and knees and helped you open it.
I was testing the soundness of the wood.
It's still got the scratches, Yash said. I looked. Someone's tried to cover them, but I saw them.
Must have been the cat.
You don't have a cat, Suze said.
I have you, Sebastian replied. That's close enough.
Julian appeared in the dining room doorway, making an entrance as usual.
The eggs are cold, darling,
Sebastian said.
I hope your constituents know the pains you go to on their behalf.
Julian did not respond. He looked out over the table at his friends and the strangers he had just met. His shy, come-hither glance was more deliberate. He couldn't quite look up. The table came to nervous attention. Stevie stiffened and put down her fork.
They found her,
Julian said quietly.
Where? Izzy said. Where is she?
Is she all right? Yash added.
Mumbled versions of these questions came from almost everyone. But not Theo. Theo looked down at her plate.
They phoned her,
Julian said with an obvious effort to keep his voice clear and steady.
In the river.
26. She had surfaced near a place called Limehouse, which was a section of the Thames on the east side of London, where the river bends. This was all there was to know. The breakfast broke up. Izzy got up and left the room. David went after her. Janelle, Vi, and Nate immediately made quiet exits. Stevie wanted to do the same, but found she could not move. Angela had been her case, her charge, her person to protect. She had known something was very wrong, but now it was final.
Let's go and sit in the other room,
Theo said gently, putting her hand on Yasha's arm as he wept.
It's more comfortable.
Suze and Peter supported each other. Sebastian sat at the table, stoic, for several more moments, looking at Julian.
Thank you,
he finally said,
for making the calls.
Julian nodded grimly.
Come on, Seb,
he said.
Let's go with the others.
They all left, and Stevie sat at a long, empty breakfast table, dotted with squares of weak sunlight and bowls of beans and sausages. Stevie felt the overwhelming need to get out of this house. It wasn't raining yet, but there was a taste of it in the air. She put in her earbuds and listened to a podcast, mostly to drown out everything around her. She had failed. failed utterly and totally. She had not saved Angela, not found Angela, not figured out what happened that night in 1995. Sure, she had gotten partway, but to something that wasn't murder, not even close. Merriweather was a good place to get lost. Its twisting paths and walls of green invited you inside, to wander, to be absorbed and never look back. The house vanished behind the curtain of trees, the walls, the high yew hedges. Here there were only the calls of birds, the giggle of the slender brook that wriggled through the grounds. She found herself in the room of topiary with the burbling fountain, the meditation spot. When she had first been diagnosed with anxiety, she had to take a meditation class. She kept forgetting to do it, even though she knew it helped, and that it worked better as a practice. It changed the brain. She turned off her podcast and closed her eyes, trying to settle herself. She listened to the birds complaining overhead, the sound of the fountain. Someone was there. She opened her eyes in a flash.
"Sorry to startle you," he said. "I came out for some air and to..."
He pulled a pack of cigarettes from his pocket.
"Do you mind?"
She shook her head. What was she going to say to him after what had just happened? That he couldn't have a cigarette outside at his friend's house, now that his other friend was dead?
"I'm the only one who still smokes, I think,"
he said, sitting next to her on the bench.
"Don't tell Theo, she'd be livid."
He put a cigarette in his mouth and lit it. Even now, maybe especially now, she saw the allure of Julian. He had an elegant slouch, a way of leaning on one knee. His eyes were so arresting, double lashes maybe. What was it about hair around the eye that was so mesmerizing?
"I'd like to speak to you, actually,"
he said, exhaling a long plume of smoke.
"It's clear you're very perceptive. I read up on you last night, in fact. The cases you've solved. Quite remarkable."
Stevie mumbled thanks.
"Last night," he said, "you asked me if they'd traced Angela's phone. I had a bit more detail about that than I let on."
"I could tell," she said.
"The pings indicated that she was walking between Waterloo and Vauxhall. That's along the river. It's about a mile and a half. That time of night, part of it would be desolate. I had a pretty good idea what that probably meant. I didn't want to upset everyone before we knew for sure."
He took a long drag, examined the cigarette, then stubbed it out carefully on the metal arm of the bench. He pinched the end to make sure it was fully extinguished, then slid it back into the pack. The pack went back into his pocket, and then he withdrew his phone.
"My contact sent me some more information just now. I want your opinion."
He passed his phone over to Stevie. There was an email up on the screen that came from someone at the Metropolitan Police. "Body found at Limehouse at 19:50 in the evening. Pronounced on scene. Time of death unable to be determined, but likely over 48 hours. No visible injuries. Purse contained, wallet, containing £40 and credit cards, intact. Set of keys, phone, Oyster card, new Oral-B toothbrush in package, box of Strepsils, blister pack of Nitol, can hold 7 tablets, 6 were missing, 1 remaining. 5 large rocks. Identification based on cards and wallet, verified through photo match pending formal identification. Postmortem scheduled for tomorrow morning."
"Nitol is sleeping medicine," Julian said. "I'm sure you could gather that by the name. There's little doubt what happened here."
"Where did she get the rocks?" Stevie asked. "Where do you get rocks in London?"
"There are many beachy areas along the Thames. It's not hard to find rocks along the shoreline, especially when the tide is out. I did check. Low tide was at 11 p.m. that night. Well, I want to ask you, these details, do you think knowing this would be easier for Izzy or harder? You're her friend, and you seem to have a head for this sort of thing. Should I tell her about those?"
"I think," Stevie said after a long moment, "she should know, but it would be easier coming from us. Could you share that with me and we can show it to her when the time is right? Or David will.
That's very sensible,
Julian agreed. He screenshotted the message and sent it over to Stevie. He thanked her, excused himself for interrupting her privacy, and left her sitting in the calm greenery. Stevie also had little doubt what had happened here. 6 sleeping pills and 5 large rocks. She was looking at the tools that had led to Angela's murder. When Stevie stepped back inside Meriwether, the house had an uneasy quiet. The doors to the sitting room were open, but no one was inside. People had dispersed. The great-grandfather clock ticked heavily. The house made an occasional conversational creak, but otherwise all was silent. She returned to her bedroom, hearing only slight noises from behind some of the doors, muffled sobs and voices. She packed quickly, pressing the fire safe back into the suitcase. Then she walked down the hall on the tips of her toes. It didn't feel like the right time to be heard walking around. She approached David's door and rapped on it softly. There was no reply. She decided to walk around a bit more, turning the corner and entering a bit of the upstairs she had not been in before. Behind one of the doors, she could just make out David's voice, soft and low. She knocked on this one, and after a moment, she was told to come in. She pushed open the door to a cheerful rose-pink bedroom with a 4-poster bed dominating the center of the room. David and Izzy were sitting on the bed. Well, not sitting. Reclining. Izzy was curled up in a near-fetal position, her head resting on David's chest. Stevie found that a lump of bile had surfaced in her throat, and she was bawling her hands into tight, nervous fists. "Hey," she said.
"One second, Iz,"
David said, slipping Izzy off his chest gently. She dropped down onto the pillows, all dead weight, and turned her face into their depths. David came over and motioned for Stevie to join him in the hall.
"She doesn't seem good."
"No," David said. "She's not."
"The car is coming in a few minutes," Stevie said. "Do you want me to get your stuff together for you?"
"Izzy needs to stay here for a little while,"
he said in a low voice.
"She wants to be here. I feel like I should stay with her."
"Stay?" Stevie asked.
"Only for a few hours. There's a train later this afternoon. And you have stuff today, right? Tea and a show or something? I can meet you after that."
He was accurate. They did have plans all that afternoon. And sure, Izzy had suffered a huge loss and needed support. He was doing the right thing. But she had just entered the final 24 hours of her trip. Everything counted now. The car ride, sitting together on the train, all these moments she couldn't have again because she was leaving England. She forced her face into something that was appropriate for the occasion. Something serious, understanding. A heavy sadness started to fall over her limbs. A few minutes later, a car came crunching up the drive, and then they were on their way back to London. Stevie turned to look at Meriwether as they went. It shrank in the distance before winking away through the trees.
"Have a nice visit,"
the driver asked cheerfully. The train ride back to London was subdued. Janelle and Vi sat on one side of a table, and Stevie and Nate on the other. After Stevie recounted what she had learned from Julian, no one said much of anything for some time. Because what could be said? The trip had resulted in nothing but bad news. The weather was dreary. Rain spat at the train windows.
"Tea is at 4, Janelle finally said. "We should make it on time."
Of course. Their final day. Tea and theater. Normal tourist things. This was supposed to be the celebration. The cherry on the sundae.
"What were you doing at breakfast?"
Nate asked.
"With the wine bottle, the whiskey. What was that about?"
"I don't know," Stevie said. "I saw the empty wine bottle on the table and I thought about how they were drinking that night. There's this point in the night that almost everyone mentions. They come back in and have the fancy bottle of whiskey. Everything kind of stops after that."
"You think they were drugged or something?" Janelle asked. Stevie shook her head noncommittally. I don't know what I think. Just something about it. It matters somehow.
Can I say something awkward? Vi cut in. You think one of your friends is a murderer. You accidentally say this out loud to your niece while you're on painkillers. Your niece tells a bunch of Americans she's just met, one of whom has solved a murder before. You tell your friends you should meet at the place where the murder happened, and then you leave the house, take a bunch of sleeping pills, and jump into the river.
And you leave one in the package in your purse, Stevie said, just in case anyone has any questions.
She was drugged and dumped in the river, Nate said. That's what we're all thinking, right?
Definitely, Stevie said. Probably.
But what can you do about it?
Janelle said. It wasn't meant unkindly. It was a practical question. And the answer seemed to be not much.
27. The tea was at a hotel in Soho. Some fancy boutique place known for elaborate afternoon tea. They had all agreed to this, but as they approached the hotel doors, Nate started to backtrack.
Maybe we could get actual food?
He asked.
It's £50 a person, and it's just tea.
It's tea and sandwiches and desserts, Janelle said. We have to do a British tea. Come on. We agreed to this. This is the last day of our trip, and we have to make something of it.
Instead of a fizzy, fun atmosphere, it was a somewhat grim group around the gaily laid table, with its lush arrangement of fresh flowers and a cheerful set of green and white china cups. Before them was placed a three-tiered selection of small sandwiches, cut into delicate, crustless rectangles. The waiter pointed at them in turn, introducing the smoked salmon with the filled cream cheese, the Stilton with apple and mayonnaise, the coronation chicken and celeriac, the Yorkshire ham and mustard. Another tiered dish came, laden with scones and Cornish clotted cream, lemon curd and jam, tiny chocolate cakes, tarts of winter fruits and bramble jelly, spiced carrot cakes with cardamom. More and more things arrived at the table. All the little plates required for the little foods, the dish of brown and white sugar lumps, rough and uneven, the silver utensils and tea strainers and the tea strainer holders and the special knives for spreading the cream. So many things. It only served to remind Stevie of that dinner at Angela's. The many bowls of curry, the rice on the side with the flecks of yellow on top, the half dozen or so chutneys and accompaniments, the breads and the poppadoms. Angela talking about Anne Boleyn. The swordsman standing there calling to an imaginary assistant to get the victim to turn their head to better meet the needs of the sword. A ruse so you could murder them.
Is anything wrong?
The server asked, concerned by the many untouched sandwiches and cakes. They all made for the food to show that they were fine, just normal tourists being normal at tea. Stevie ate a little chocolate cake. It landed in her stomach like a lump of wet sand. She checked her messages. Nothing from David.
How's it going? She wrote. Do you know when you'll be back?
No dots appeared. It was almost 5 o'clock. Their show started at 7. Richard III. Stevie felt like watching a play about as much as she felt like tipping this pot of scalding hot tea into her own lap. But what else was there to do? Angela was dead. She'd failed. And she would be leaving England tomorrow. The show was at the Barbican, which was a complex built of concrete, a fortress, sort of like the Tower of London. It was made of bare concrete lumps instead of stone towers. More brutalism, Janelle told them.
How did anyone make something this ugly? Vi asked. They could have made anything at all, and they decided to make this.
I kind of love it, Nate said, looking around. It looks like the moisture farm that Luke Skywalker lives on.
Me too, Janelle added. It feels like a machine.
Two different ways of looking at a big concrete block, Vi replied.
If you'd asked Stevie what Richard III was about, she would have said 2.5 hours, with a few minutes in the middle to get some expensive M&Ms from the lobby and shove them down her face near a concrete pole. There were a lot of people in tunics running on and off stage, seemingly all of them named Richard or Edward or Lord this or that, with the occasional Catesby thrown in to keep things confusing. Stevie had her phone in her lap for the entire performance, checking for texts from David that did not come, much to the annoyance of the woman sitting beside her, who huffed and tutted until Stevie got up and sat in the lobby for the final 15 minutes. She must have missed the scene where Richard begged for a horse. She could guess that he wasn't going to get one. No horse for you, Richard. She didn't want to be angry. She didn't want to be wandering around the lobby of a brutalist building with only hours left to go in this country before she would be ripped away from all this, from David, from the case, from the misting rain and the relentless tea drinking.
Why did you leave?
Janelle said as they exited the theater at the end of the play. Sorry, Stevie replied. I just couldn't sit there anymore.
I didn't really like it either, Vi said, rubbing the peach fuzz on the back of their head. The events of the day had gotten the better of them. No amount of tiny cakes and tea and screaming English lords was going to fix it.
On the tube ride back to Craven House, the group settled into a damp silence.
The silence came from the knowledge that the trip was pretty much officially over at this point, and the damp from the invisible rain that had attacked them on the way to the station. I'm going to figure it out on the plane, Janelle said out of nowhere. How many schools? I'm going to pick them on the plane. I'll have 8 hours and probably no internet. I just need to get it done.
She turned to Vi, silently asking the question, "Are you in?" Because their project was largely a joint one.
Maybe, Vi said. Can we see? I might just want to watch movies. Planes are so, I guess, sad on planes sometimes.
Janelle slid her arm over Vi's shoulder and kissed their forehead. Stevie could tell she was disappointed in the answer, but if planes made Vi sad, there was no way she was going to push it.
How about you? She asked Nate. Want to work lists with me?
What?
I need to spreadsheet. Janelle said, figure this out. We can work on our lists. Want to?
I'm good, Nate said.
Just tell me how many you've gotten down to. I need to figure this out. I need to make something work.
Stevie lifted her head from her phone, which wasn't really getting a good signal on the tube anyway. Something was happening here. Janelle was about as frustrated as Stevie had ever seen her. The fact that this trip hadn't been quite what she'd expected was eating at her, and she had to pull a victory from the rubble.
How many have you applied to so far? She asked. I need something to work with. Data.
Nate looked up like Janelle had pulled a gun on him.
Come on, Janelle said. What, is it a secret?
Nate's expression suggested that it was very much a secret. He was being evasive in a way that didn't quite make sense. Something bubbled in Stevie's mind. There had been a pattern developing. She'd been clocking it without being entirely aware that she was doing so. Nate had been writing all the time. Or, Nate had been doing something on his computer. He'd been skipping the occasional meal or coffee, and his credit card wasn't working.
Oh my God, Stevie said. You've been applying to schools. That's what you've been doing.
Nate's face flushed a faint purple. She'd hit the mark. Janelle and Vi looked to Stevie in confusion.
How many? Stevie asked.
Nate looked at her with an expression that said, I am never letting you use my Ace Pride drone.
71,
he finally said. Silence for a moment from the assembled.
Is that even legal? Vi finally asked.
How? Janelle said. How did you apply to 71 schools? You'd had to have applied somewhere every day for the last 2 months.
Not every day,
Nate said, his shoulders sagging.
Not every day. There's the common application, and you can use a lot of the stuff over again. It's not that.
How did you even get all the recommendation letters? Vi asked.
I didn't use Ellingham, he said in a low voice. I asked my editor and agent to write letters. and this guy who runs a book festival. They gave me form letters that I could adjust to wherever I was sending them.
71, Janelle repeated. That's... How much did that even cost?
Having admitted this much, Nate was prepared to give his full confession.
$5,740, he said. So far. Some of them haven't run my card yet. I don't know where to go, okay? And I thought, if I'm going to have to be in debt for the rest of my life to go to school, I should probably pick the right one. But they're all just brick buildings and people walking around with backpacks and doing presentations in front of whiteboards full of triangles, and I have no fucking idea which one to choose. There are the little weird ones where you can make your own major, so you can study the history of teacups or vibes or whatever you want. There are big ones that have buildings with pillars, and they offer everything, and it's like living in a city. And then there's where, like, they are all in cute little towns where the leaves are always changing. Or are in the city. There are some near the beach. There's one where everyone kite surfs all the time.
Kite surfs, Janelle repeated. You. Kite surfing. I don't know. They don't make you kite surf. I'm just saying.
Do you even like the beach? Stevie asked.
Everyone likes the beach. I'm a swimmer. I'm just saying, I don't know where to go, so I figured I'd cast a wide net.
The train arrived at their stop, and they disembarked quietly. At least Stevie had solved one mystery, even if it had raised more questions than it had answered. When they got back to Craven House, Stevie went directly to David and Izzy's side of the building. She knocked on his door but got no answer. She asked a few people who walked by and eventually found someone who knew where Izzy's room was. It was at the other end of the hall, through two fire doors and down a pointless set of three steps. Beyond the door, Stevie could hear music playing, low, something calm. When she knocked, there was the sound of movement, a pause, and then Izzy opened the door. To Stevie's surprise, she immediately caught her in an embrace.
Come in, she said.
Though Izzy had the same basic room as Stevie occupied, it had none of the plastic quality. The bed was covered in a thick, sunshine yellow duvet with white dots. The walls were hung with prints and colorful boards on which schedules, reading lists, and little handwritten notes were pinned. Her desk was stacked with books, empty champagne bottles, a pair of engraved wine glasses, a feather boa around a mirror. There was a white shag rug on the floor, along with a pile of fuzzy pillows. David was resting on and against this assortment of plush objects. He nodded to her, but didn't move to get up.
I was wondering if I could talk to David, Stevie said.
Oh, of course, of course.
David peeled himself from the carpet with less enthusiasm than she anticipated. Stevie didn't know what was happening, but it appeared that he wasn't particularly eager to speak to her. Tonight. Their last night together. He stepped out into the hall, shutting the door behind him.
When did you get back? She asked, trying to act like she hadn't noticed anything amiss.
About an hour ago.
An hour? That was so late.
Do you want to come back with me?
I will, he said. She's still wrecked. Let me stay with her for a little bit and I'll come over.
But you've been gone all day, she said.
It didn't come out the way she meant it to. It was sharp, peevish.
Her aunt just died, he said.
I know that, Stevie said.
I just need to make sure she's okay and then I'll come over.
Are you mad at me? She asked.
What?
Because I failed, she said.
She lowered her voice, conscious of the other people coming in and out of their rooms, and Izzy just beyond the door.
This isn't about you, he said. It's not about whether or not you solved it, like you always do.
The words were like a slap. Stevie reeled. He'd gotten her feelings, but also her pride. She straightened up.
It's fine, she said. Don't worry about it.
She turned and walked away without saying anything else. She expected him to call out, to catch up with her. She lingered for a moment by the one fire door like she was looking for something in her pocket. But he didn't come.
The same when she lingered by the next fire door, and the lobby. She almost turned back, but realized that would not work. She had to do this on his schedule now. She waited with the door cracked halfway open for most of the night, lingering, trying to look ready, but not too ready, casual. She tried to read, to listen to something, to watch TV. But she had to keep one ear open for any movement in the hall, any sign of a message. Midnight passed. 1 in the morning. 2. Her lack of sleep from the night before caught up with her. She fell asleep sitting up, wearing the onesie. The door open a crack all night long. No one came. 28. Stevie woke to a steady patter of rain on the window. A steely London morning. Last night was a waste, and now all she had was... She consulted her phone. 4 hours. That's how much time she had left before they went to the airport. Also, no texts from David. That had been a bad scene last night, a weird argument. He'd had a point. She had been focused on herself, on them. Izzy had experienced a terrible loss. But it was still her last day, and now the last hours, and he'd spent the entire day yesterday with Izzy. Was it so much to want to see the boyfriend you'd crossed the ocean to visit? Maybe no text was a good sign. This was how they were. They got mad at each other, walked it off, and came back fresh. There was just so little time. She took a speedy shower, missing the rainfall-style water and the beautiful-smelling soaps of the day before. She dressed before she was fully dry, her jeans clinging to her damp legs as she pulled them on. She stared at her stuff scattered around the room. Dirty clothes, bags, some jam for her mom, some weird tea, a book about murders. All these cords and adapters and things to charge and documents to find. She needed to pack. But she also needed to see David immediately. She would bring him over here while she packed. She had to take the fire safe back over to Izzy anyway. In the confusion of leaving Meriwether without Izzy or David, she had ended up taking it with her. She hustled down the hall, bypassing the far-too-slow little elevator and taking the stairs far too quickly. She half ran through the lobby, past the sad Christmas tree, then ran up the steps to David's room. She knocked. Nothing. Tried again. Tried the door. Locked. She texted him. "Where are you?"
"Down the street getting a coffee,"
he answered. "I'll meet you outside," she replied. She considered running the fire safe up to Izzy, but that would take too much time. She took it outside with her and waited on the front steps of Craven House, shivering in the chill. It took David at least 15 minutes to come back with his coffee, which was ridiculous. Every second counted now. She tried to compose herself. Look patient, not desperate. Cool, like it was no big deal. Just a girl with a fire safe about to catch a plane and leave her boyfriend. He finally appeared from around a parked van, the coat snapping around his ankles. He was wearing a worn green t-shirt and jeans, as well as a black knit hat. He had put no effort into this, she knew. He probably hadn't even showered. This kind of effortless bullshit was part of his appeal. She both resented it and felt it tugging at every part of her.
"I got you a coffee,"
he said quietly. Already, her ice was starting to melt. "Thanks," she said, accepting it. She expected him to sit on the step next to her, but he remained standing. He wasn't smiling, which made sense as they were about to be parted. But his expression was distant, distracted almost. "Do you want to... sit?" she asked.
"How about we walk for a minute?"
Stevie nodded toward the heavy fire safe.
"I'll carry it," he said. "Let's walk."
"I have to pack," she said.
10 minutes. Look at the view."
She could maybe do 10 minutes, though her pulse was quickening. They walked the familiar path in the direction of the river, but David's steps were slow. "You didn't text last night," she said.
"No. Sorry."
"Or come by."
You said not to.
I said whatever, she clarified. I didn't say... There was no time for this, much as it irritated her. He had wasted the last night they had together on semantics and pettiness.
You haven't asked how Izzy is, he said, sipping his coffee.
How is she? Stevie asked.
Pretty bad. But getting English about it again. Stiff upper lip. She's going to speak to the undertaker today to plan the funeral.
This was not something Stevie had considered. Funerals were things that just happened. She didn't know. She had never been to one. But to have to plan one yourself? Call an undertaker? I'm sorry, she said.
Not your fault.
No, I know, but it still feels...
It's not about you, he had said.
David stopped, even though they had not gotten to the riverside yet. They were standing on the street by the bus stop. He drained his coffee in one long final gulp and dropped the cup into the trash. Are we crossing the street? She said. Because I kind of need to pack, and I thought you could come with me while I do it. He rubbed at the tip of his nose.
I know,
he said.
I get it. I get it.
He had no idea what it was he got, and she had no idea what he got twice. Stevie felt something in the left side of her chest, around her heart. It felt to her like her blood had started running backward in her veins. What's happening right now? She asked. It was in the way he moved his chin, down, a little to the left. His eyes were focused on a delivery bike chained to a pole. He kept widening his eyes slightly, like he was trying to wake up. He pulled the lapels of his coat closed over his chest.
You and me, he said. I'm...
A seismic tremor passed over her nervous system. Her muscles went rigid.
I don't think we should do this anymore,
he said, looking down at his hands.
It's not working out.
What do you mean? She said, panic rising in her throat. He couldn't be saying this. This could not be happening.
I don't think... It's good.
Is this Izzy? She asked. He cocked his head and shook it.
Izzy? No, nothing with me and Izzy. It's me. It's...
Her phone was ringing.
You should answer that, he said.
She wanted to throw the phone into the street. Instead, she stared at it. It was Janelle. She didn't answer.
I'm sorry, he said.
He didn't look at her.
You should probably go back. It's easier that way.
David, she said, her voice a croak. This seemed to affect him, and he drew his arms closer into himself.
Let me know you got back okay,
he said.
When you land.
And then he turned and walked away, down the street, taking the fire safe with him. She wanted to run after him, but found she couldn't move. She was magnetized to the sidewalk. Her brain was free-falling. It was a gentle fall, slow, like a feather on the wind, tacking back and forth toward the ground. It was almost funny. She might laugh, except there was a hollow ringing in her ears. The phone rang again, and she answered it. Where are you? Janelle said, out of breath. We're... He dumped me, Stevie replied before bursting into tears. There was not a moment's hesitation. We're coming, she said. Where are you?
What the hell happened?
Nate said as Janelle and Vi helped Stevie back to her room a few minutes later. Stevie was crying so hard she was hiccuping violently. Janelle and Vi eased her onto the bed. He dumped her, Vi explained.
What? Just now?
Just now, Janelle said, because he's an asshole. This was a crisis, and one that required organization. In other words, this was Janelle's moment to shine. They sat Stevie on the bed, and Janelle surveyed the mess around her. She looked almost pleased, like this was the kind of challenge she had been waiting for. Okay, she said. We have 5 minutes. Vi, Everything out of the closet and drawers. Just dump it here in the pile. I'll sort and pack. Nate?
Nate was retreating away from the doorway.
Get her some water.
Nate vanished, waterward.
As quick as Vi could throw items, Janelle plucked them up and rolled them. Everything. The dirty underwear and socks. The overworn t-shirts. She found a nook for everything, from the unused tampons to the spare coat. She wrapped the jam and a coffee mug in clothes, picked through the toiletries, leaving behind anything that was no longer viable or posed a leak risk. Watching her, Stevie found that her crying was slowing. She was out of moisture, out of energy, transfixed by movement like a lizard. Nate returned with a bottle of water. He approached Stevie cautiously, like she might explode. She accepted it and tried to drink, but it started her hiccups again. Nate sat next to her, keeping an inch or two between them.
Do you want me to...
He searched for something to say.
I don't know, punch him in the dick or something?
Leave that for me,
Janelle said, maneuvering the last items into the bag.
Where's your passport, Stevie?
Stevie glanced around and pointed at her backpack. Soon, everything had been accounted for. They gave her a cloth to wipe her face, took a box of tissues, and headed out. Stevie wondered if the elevator door would open and he'd be in the lobby, ready to apologize and call it all off. But of course he wasn't. Vi had gathered up their keys and placed them on the front desk. Her room was gone.
All keys look the same, they said, trying to make conversation while the front desk person checked the keys back in. You would think there would be more designs of keys.
Janelle gestured that the car had arrived, and that was that. They were back in the car, back on the motorway, going back the way they had come. Before David, Stevie had never had a boyfriend. That meant that she had never known what it meant to suddenly not have one. She had not experienced someone saying, "I don't want to be with you." It made no sense. It was David, her David, Stevie and David. A giant hole had been ripped in the backdrop of her life, revealing some weird, indistinct vista ahead. England was being wiped away mile by mile. Looking out the window reinforced her imminent departure, so Stevie closed her eyes. At first, the darkness brought a wild swell of pain, emotion she couldn't control or understand. It was a wave, and she was going under and would not survive. She pressed her eyes tightly, trying to remember the meditation tricks she'd learned to deal with anxiety. She would retreat so far inside herself the world would never see her again. Let the thoughts and feelings come. Just acknowledge them and let them be. There was no name for this staggering monolith of heartbreak. She tried to note that it was pain. Pain, 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 fear, pain, agony, panic, pain, nausea, embarrassment, anger, loss. Under all of that, something was calling to her.
You saw it, said a voice in her head. You saw it.
Saw what? Where?
The voice in her head mumbled, cleared its throat. Stevie could almost hear it shuffling its note cards.
House, it finally replied. House. You saw it in her house.
Stevie grabbed this mental lifeline. She would give it every ounce of her being. She tightened her jaw and put in earbuds and blasted Britpop at herself. Get into the feeling of the time, the rhythm, the mindset, the jangling guitars and joking lyrics. She closed her eyes and floated around Angela's house in her mind. She materialized in the living room, staring down at the sofa. What color was it? Emerald. The wall behind it was slate gray. There were crumbs on the coffee table. There was the smell of the curry. This was followed by the smell of the curry in the garbage later. The sourness. What else? Angela kept money in her kitchen, a fire safe under the stairs, books in every room, books and beheadings.
We are here, Vi said gently.
They had stopped in front of the massive glass and metal of Heathrow Airport. They were inside, dragging bags, waiting in line. Then the bags were tagged and taken away on a conveyor belt, and they were off to security to put their remaining belongings in bins. Remaining belongings. What were they again? Sleeping pills, rocks, keys, phone, throat drops, a toothbrush, maybe. Something else. She followed along behind the others, weaving through the crowds. She cast a dazed and sad eye over the many things the airport offered to her as she left. Surely she couldn't depart England without a bottle of whiskey, a set of china teacups, a Paddington bear, a biography of some grim-looking sports dude, an overpriced purse, a shawl, several bottles of perfume. Did people come to the airport just to set their money on fire? There were more practical offerings as well. Every other shop offered candy, water, luggage tags, and toothbrushes. Stuff you might have forgotten or need on the way. You saw it, said the voice as Stevie was cleared through security. You walked right by it.
Are you okay? Janelle said. You haven't said a word in almost an hour.
Yeah, she mumbled. I should get some water. She spent the last of her English cash on a giant bottle of water and a candy bar. England was going to be over in less than an hour. Every step along the stark white corridors of Heathrow was a step away from everything. It was over. They followed the golden yellow signs to their gate, where they had to go through one last passport and document check. Stevie was behind her friends, letting her vision go blurry.
If you go, the voice said to her, you will never know.
I have to, Stevie replied internally. Then you'll never know what you saw. Never know what happened. Nate was beeped through. Janelle. Vi. Stevie stepped out of the line.
Where are you going?
Nate said. I just need to pee, she said. I'll be there in a second. They had already crossed into the lounge. Stevie stepped back into the bathroom that was a few feet away from the line and locked herself into a stall. Her heart began to beat a little faster, and the fluorescent glow of the bathroom made a halo around her view of the world. It was so close. It was right there. She squeezed her eyes shut. What had she seen? A buzz. A text.
Are you okay?
Janelle wrote. Stevie. Fine. Peeing. Janelle.
Still?
Janelle.
Hurry.
Janelle. We're getting on. Janelle.
Stevie, we're on the plane.
Janelle.
Where are you?
Stevie was in the stall. She remained there when she heard, Final call for Flight 17 to Boston. All passengers must immediately report to Gate 27. Janelle.
They just closed the boarding door? What the hell is going on?
Stevie stepped out of the stall and gripped the edge of the sink as the announcement came that the gate was closed. She lifted her phone and texted a reply. I have to finish this, she wrote to the three of them. I will get another flight. Not lying. Not pulling you into it. I will see you at home. She switched off her phone and turned around to leave the airport. 29. Making her way back into London by herself at night was a different experience. She took the Heathrow Express, backtracking to Paddington. There was no warm bed waiting for her, no loving boyfriend, no friends at her side, no support of Ellingham Academy backing the trip. Just her and a phone rapidly running out of charge. There was enough to send one text message. As soon as she got the reply, she put her head back and tried to close her eyes. Tried to focus. Tried to keep the grief from pressing on her chest. There was work to be done. The train dumped her at Paddington, where she emerged in a crush of commuters. She used the remaining battery power on her phone to navigate the streets, winding her way back to Angela's shiny black door. Izzy was waiting there, in her blue coat and a big palm hat. Doorknob wound around her. Izzy wore no makeup, and her eyes were puffy from crying. You missed your plane, Izzy said in greeting as Stevie approached the door.
Are you going to be in trouble?
Yes, Stevie said simply.
What are you looking for?
Izzy said, unlocking the door. I don't know. But I know I saw something, the thing that makes this all make sense. I just have to look at everything again until I recognize what it is.
Left unattended, even for a few days, houses take on a strange feel. The cold accumulates in the corners. The dark settles down and pools on the furniture. Quiet leaks everywhere. The air sours. Doorknob was fine with all this. He scrabbled inside, ran up the stairs like a bat out of hell, ran down again just as fast, chasing nothing. It struck her instantly. She'd been too preoccupied to see the obvious. She went right to the little cabinet under the stairs, which was still partway open. She turned on her phone flashlight and shoved her head into the space, digging around until she could put her hand on Doorknob's disgusting little treasures. Part of a dead mouse, a used tea bag, a dirty cotton swab, a tissue, two buttons. She plucked them out and brought them into the light, setting them on the coffee table. One was bright pink, the other silver. And once they were on display, Stevie instantly began to dismiss them. If Angela had a critical piece of evidence in the form of a button, it seemed like she would lock it up in the secure fire safe rather than let her cat get it. Besides, these buttons were next to the fire safe.
"We think this is evidence," Izzy said, looking down at them doubtfully. "From 1995.
Stevie deflated a bit when she heard the tone. "They're buttons," she replied. "I just wanted to see them."
"This one," Izzy said, pointing at the bright pink one. "I think this comes off a sweater she has. It's this color and it buttons down the front. I can check upstairs. And this one," Izzy leaned close to look at it, "it says Stella McCartney."
Stevie drew a blank. The name sounded familiar. McCartney.
"I don't think Stella McCartney was designing in the 90s, Izzy said. "Let me check."
Stevie deflated a bit further as Izzy checked her phone.
2001, she said. "And I think I might know what this is from because I borrowed it once."
"I was just thinking about the button," Stevie said, trying to seem in control of this situation. "I just wanted to check."
"Of course," Izzy said. Her voice was full of confidence. "Look around. I trust you. Do whatever you have to do."
That landed strangely. Izzy trusted her. For a moment, the gravity of what she had done settled on Stevie. She had gone AWOL in another country, and now she was standing here in the half-light of a dead woman's house, trying to work out a feeling. She pulled off her coat and got to work. She opened her bag and fished out her phone charger, then she walked up the stairs, touching the gray banister lightly with her fingertips, moving into the shadow at the top. She plugged her phone into the socket in the upstairs hallway, switched it to Do Not Disturb mode, and turned on the mix of Britpop songs. She put in her earbuds and began walking around the upstairs. She went to the bedroom first. Neat and precise Angela. Cashmere sweaters folded and shoes in clear shoeboxes. Just one book on the bedside stand, a biography of Catherine Howard, bookmarked in the middle. One book at a time, not the jumble of books in process that lay splayed by Stevie's bedside. She went into the bathroom and took a moment to go through the medicine cabinet. Floss, deodorant, extra heads for her electric toothbrush, a tub of skin cream, nail polish remover, a bottle of bright pink indigestion medicine, birth control pills, and cold medicine. No sleeping pills. In the office, she worked her way around the room, staring down the spines of the history books on the shelves. She looked at every framed photograph. There were the formal photos from Cambridge, the group shots, the graduation photographs in the strange, sleeveless dark gowns with the collars that looked like skunk fur, the framed posters from the 9's shows, posters from her documentaries, pictures of Angela with friends and family, with Izzy at different ages. Stevie sat in the desk chair and spun. What were you thinking, Angela, when you were gathering your box of evidence? Where did you find Samantha Gravis? What made you think of her? What did you remember or see or hear?
What sent you looking into the past at an American pretending to be a Canadian who hooked up with two of your friends and then fell into a river and died? Just like you. Who likes rivers, Angela? Who kills with waterways and an axe? There was something in that. The contrast. Samantha had a blow to the head and sank in the shallow waters. And Angela was full of medicine to make her sleepy. She wouldn't have suffered. But Rosie and Noel? They suffered.
Talk to me,
she said to the light fixture on the ceiling.
What did you know?
Who called you? What did I see here that doesn't make sense? Doorknob poked his head into the room. He rubbed his big orange body on the doorframe and purred loudly. He walked up to Stevie and rammed his head into her shins as a greeting. He allowed her to pick him up, going happily limp in her arms.
What the hell am I missing, Doorknob? She asked.
Doorknob circled her lap and coiled up into a resting position. She stroked him absently. She spun toward the desk and grabbed a pen to write a list. Things that keep coming up. A lock. A button. Samantha Gravis. This was an equation. These three things somehow added up to the answer. What did they have in common? Not much. The lock was on the door of the woodshed. Samantha Gravis was in Cambridge. And no one knew where or what the button was. There didn't even seem to be a button. Doorknob yawned and stretched himself, almost rolling off her lap in the process. She grabbed him before he fell. She felt that sizzling feeling between her eyes. Doorknob's purring sounds powered it. She let him wriggle and drop to the floor. She took the steps two at a time, down to the kitchen, where Izzy was washing the disgusting curry-stained dishes, which were furry with mold.
The text messages, Stevie said. Show me her text messages again.
She tried not to scream with impatience as Izzy peeled off the washing gloves to get the tablet from her bag. Stevie clutched it and scanned down the exchange. 9:46 p.m. Angela.
She had the button.
9:47 p.m. Theo. Question mark? 9:48 p.m. Suze.
What Theo said?
9:48 p.m. Yash.
Button.
9:49 p.m. Peter.
What?
9:50 p.m. Suze.
I have to go back on stage. Please, someone explain to me what is happening.
9:51 p.m. Sebastian.
Can you ring me?
9:55 p.m. Theo.
And?
She got the call at 9:53, Stevie said. That's 7 minutes after her last text. That button got someone's attention. 7 minutes. Stevie continued saying 7 minutes for perhaps 7 minutes. She was almost shaking now. She looked around the kitchen in desperation. She had still seen something in this house.
What the hell did I see? She yelled.
The answer was all about Angela. What Angela had been doing, what Angela said. What happened that night that made her spring into action moments after Stevie and the others had gone. Perhaps recreating the scene would help.
Come on,
Stevie said to Izzy, who was watching Stevie's wild stares and strange proclamations wide-eyed.
I was sitting here, Stevie said, finding the spot on the floor she had occupied. You were over there. Sit there, exactly as you were. Think back. What were we talking about the other night before we started talking about the murders?
Mostly history. The Tower of London, Guy Fawkes. It was a lot about Anne Boleyn, I think.
About her execution, how it was different from a lot of other executions. She had a special swordsman from France, and she had to sit up straight because of it. You put your head down if it's an axe, but you have to sit up for a sword, and the swordsman pulled some kind of trick to get her head in the right position.
Stevie looked at the two buttons on the coffee table.
Click, click, click.
A sequence of things snapped into place. This was how it happened. All the things she had been collecting, all her ruminations and wandering thoughts,
all that she had ever absorbed from mysteries and true crime and puzzles, all those times she read Wikipedia articles about gruesome things until 3 in the morning, all that she had observed without knowing, it brewed in her head. It bubbled. It seethed. It would not be ready until it was ready. But when it was ready, it cascaded over like one of those model volcanoes she built in grade school that spat up baking soda and vinegar lava. It was the great hork of realization. Stevie looked up at Izzy in a kind of wonder.
There's no button, she said.
We haven't found it yet, but...
No, Stevie said. There is no button. That's the point. And if there's no button... The thoughts were coming quickly. Stevie had no ability to articulate them. If she tried, she would lose it all. Did you take out the trash? She said.
It smelled bad, Izzy replied.
Oh, God, Stevie said. Is it gone?
I think it's still in the bins out front.
Stevie tripped over her own feet in her haste to get up, sending doorknob flying off in fear. She hurried down the steps and leaned over the little black wrought iron fence to get at the bins. They were still full of pungent garbage. She pulled out the bags and brought them back into the house. This time, she didn't even bother to line the kitchen floor with plastic bags before she upturned the contents. She dug in with her bare hands, pushing aside the food wrappers and napkins. Her eyes fell on a small slip of paper stained with curry and dotted with bits of rice. She lifted this out and studied it in silence for several minutes. Then she ran up the steps to Angela's bathroom. She examined this for a minute, then slowly returned to the living room and looked at Izzy. That friend of your family who works at the London Eye. I need you to call them.
Why?
Because I know what happened, Stevie said, clutching the filthy piece of paper, her eyes glowing. And now I have to prove it. 30. It was bitter now, with an unkind wind blowing off the Thames. It made Stevie's eyes water as she and Izzy made their determined way along the embankment and over Hungerford Bridge. She did not turn her head to look at Parliament over to her right, with the glowing face of Big Ben. She was not here to think about the view, to recall being here with David and her friends. This was being a detective in London, focused, facing the cold, alone. How long will they give us? Stevie asked Izzy.
I think as long as you need. They're doing maintenance on one of the pods, so they're keeping it stationary. They'll let us down when we text. They were very nice about it when I said it was for a memorial.
That was how they had set it up and how they drew in the 6 remaining members of the 9. Izzy had messaged them to say she had gotten a private pod on the Eye, and they could hover over London in peace and pay tribute to Angela over the river in which she had been found. Julian and Sebastian were staying in London for Angela's memorial and to be with their friends. Suze's understudy was playing her part, and Theo had taken a few days off. They were all together, so it was a relatively easy business to summon them as a group. Stevie sniffed. Her nose was running in the cold. She felt dirty and scrappy in her well-worn travel clothes, and her red vinyl coat was too thin. It was good to be cold, though. It kept her sharp. The 6 were already there when they arrived, sitting on the benches by the empty lines of the Eye. The last passengers disembarked.
Thank you for coming, Izzy said. I know this is a bit unusual, but my aunt loved writing this, and since we have a family connection...
It's a lovely gesture,
Theo said. She sounded congested, like she had been crying a lot.
Stevie, Suze said, I thought you were all leaving today.
I missed my flight, Stevie answered. Izzy gave me a place to stay, and I wanted to, you know.
It's good of you, Yash said.
And we brought a hamper,
Peter said, holding up a small basket with some bottles and glasses.
Something for a toast.
Izzy stepped up to the person manning the platform and explained who they were. After a moment's discussion, they were all shown to a pod. The door was sealed, and the wheel began to rotate. Stevie looked at the massive spokes. The river fell away, dark and forbidding, and London gleamed around them. Peter and Julian opened the bottles and distributed glasses of whiskey to those who wanted alcohol, and sparkling elderflower drink to those who did not. Yash had brought a portable speaker and started to play music. Some Britpop, of course. Some Blur. Stevie knew the sound of them by now. This was a slow, pensive song called Best Days. As the wheel crested, the six put their arms around each other's shoulders, even inviting Izzy and Stevie into the huddle. This was awkward, but Stevie slipped in between Suze and Julian.
"We love you, Ange," Suze said. "We're so sorry."
"We love you,"
Sebastian echoed. It went around. Julian, Peter, Theo, Yash, Izzy. Stevie tucked her head down. Just as the pod reached the peak, it slowed, then stopped completely. It wobbled when the wind hit it.
"To Ange," Sebastian said, raising his glass. "A historian, a writer, a thinker, a drinker."
"To Ange," everyone echoed. Stevie lifted her fancy sprite shyly. Of course, the nine, or the six, had made this into an event. But as the quiet settled over the group and the wind knocked against the pod, and Stevie realized just how high up they were inside a metal and glass bubble on a windy major river, she knew it was time. She looked to Izzy, who was wiping tears from her face with the back of her hand, smearing mascara and black eyeliner in all directions. She cleared her throat.
"Actually,"